From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Tom Davis is my guest this week. He was the Davis half of Franken and Davis, the comedy team who contributed to the early days of Saturday Night Live. His new book is called 39 Years of Short-Term Memory Loss, which is a funny title, but it's inaccurate because Tom Davis seems to have a very detailed memory of the last 39 years. Despite an occasional indulgence in mind-altering substances, Tom Davis, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and I've been in Portland about 2 hours, and I've already had a lot of fun, and this is my kind of town, I can tell right now.
Well, it seems to me from your book that you have fun wherever you go.
That is one of my themes, yes.
Well, listen, I want to ask you about your book. Did you have any second thoughts about discussing drug use in your memoir? I mean, people don't talk about drugs the way, you know, that they took the way you do in your book.
They don't, and I think that it would be better if they did, but it's hard because some of my friends who shared some of those early experiences with me are now the parents of teenage children. And for some of them, it was a little irksome, and I don't have children. It was a conscious decision I made, which I think was responsible, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. I don't have them either.
If I had teenage children, I might not have been quite so candid on that subject.
But what if you were running for, say, senator, United States senator?
I don't think I would pursue that subject either, especially if I had been straight since 1980. I think that it wouldn't be relevant, and my opponent might have been a roadie for 10 years after at Woodstock, so it wouldn't be an issue anyway, fortunately. But I certainly am excited about the possibilities of Al Franken becoming the a senator from Minnesota, and despite the vitriol that has happened and the hard feelings on both sides, I predict that Minnesotans will be very proud that they have such a brilliant senator with such a profound sense of civic duty.
Well, you know, now that Al Franken has been, you know, writing about politics and doing his radio program and so on, it doesn't seem so crazy for him to run for office. But if you were to say, you know, in 1975, think, my buddy here will someday be a United States senator, would that seem absurd then?
It wouldn't have seemed absurd to me in 1968 when I met him in high school. Seriously, it's mentioned in his year. I mean, jokingly, he used to say, and then I remember when I was sworn in the yearbook. And he had a wonderful sense of politics that I learned from. I mean, so political satire became a staple for us, and I'm grateful to him for that. But no, it doesn't surprise me at all. Of course, a lot of people have lumped him together. Minnesota once elected Jesse Ventura to
right.
be a governor, and he was a wrestler. And so they've kind of said, well, we had a wrestler, and now we're going to have a comedian. And that doesn't, I don't think that that's quite fair to lump him with Jesse Ventura, who, you know, talks like that a little.
Well, Al Franken was a great comedian, and Jesse Ventura was a crappy wrestler.
But an entertaining, crappy wrestler. Let's give him credit for that.
Right.
And Al was a brilliant comedian, but he always had this profound sense of politics, and I didn't realize probably how serious it was. But he's senatorial now, and he has to embrace some of these life and death kind of issues that brings that serious stuff out, I can only imagine.
Well, Franken and Davis were kind of, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but sort of a satire of comedy teams while actually being a comedy team. What comedians did you admire when you were growing up?
Well, if you saw the Franken and Davis show on Saturday Night Live, we had like an animated opening with caricatures of ourselves. And then we'd come out and introduce our show in the style of the Jack Benny program. And that was a very conscious decision on our part. We love Jack Benny. But we also were probably influenced the most by Bob and Ray, and for your younger viewers who may not have heard of Bob and Ray, they were a team that did radio out of Boston from the early 50s. They briefly had a television show for NBC, I think, on Saturday mornings. That it looked like a kiddie show, but it wasn't. They're really adult comedy all the time. And Ray died in, I think, 1991, but Bob is still very much alive. I reproduce one of their sketches in my book, and I had to call up Bob to get permission. It was, ring, hello? It was like, hi, Bob, this is Tom Davis, remember? Well, yes, I do. Nice of you to call up after 30 years. Because we did a show with Bob and Ray called Bob and Ray, Lorraine, Jane, and Gilda.
Were you responsible for that episode of the... It was kind of an episode of Saturday Night Live. They preempted Saturday Night Live.
It's also one of the themes of my book is working with your heroes. And Bob and Ray were our heroes, and we went out of our way to get to know them. We went to their office in the Gray Bar building right next to Grand Central Station. Oh, by the way, Grand Central Terminal is the proper term. Someone just corrected me the other day because that's the end of the line there.
Oh, right.
Yeah, but who says, take me to Grand Central Terminal? It's like, get me to Grand Central Station, so it's one of those things.
It's a lovely place.
The vernacular interests me, naturally. But Bob and Ray were definitely huge influences. Now, so were the classic comedians like Laurel and Hardy and W.C. Fields. And then we had our contemporaries Jimmy Walker and Gabe Kaplan and Pat Proft, who writes the Naked Gun series with Leslie Nielsen. He actually comes from Minnesota. And Al and I used to watch him on the stage at Dudley Riggs Theater in Minneapolis. That's like a Second City type theater. And that's the first place that we got on the stage there. And Pat Proft is going to appear with me in Los Angeles with Lorraine Newman when we have a book event there.
Oh, that'll be fun. Now, you mentioned some of the other comedians in your book that one of my heroes was... Professor Irwin Corey. You tell a funny story about him. So you must have encountered a lot of people on the road when you guys were playing live.
Well, there is a lot about stand-up comedy in the book. There's a lot about Saturday Night Live, obviously.
Yeah.
And there's a lot about the Grateful Dead.
Yeah. What was your act like? I've seen you on Saturday Night Live, but I never caught Franken and Davis live. What was it like?
Irreverent, bitingly satirical, acerbic, original, except when we occasionally borrowed too much from Bob and Ray. But we would steal their formulas more than we wouldn't steal jokes. We'd steal people's formulas and make them into our own. That's what a lot of comedians do. And so when you steal from someone, you say that they're big influences.
What about rock and roll? I mean, you mentioned the Grateful Dead already in our conversation, but you talk in your book about going to a Hendrix concert and how you went in as one person and came out as a completely other person.
Yes, yeah, it happens in people's lives. It certainly happened to me. In a matter of 3 hours, I walked into the Minneapolis Armory in 1968. It was my first rock and roll show. I loved the Beatles, but walking into this building, I wanted to be a Marine in Vietnam. And when I walked out, I wanted to grow my hair long, smoke pot, and make love to women.
And so that was the course of action you pursued.
It was, and I don't find any fault in that at all. I think that it served me well. I still like making love to women, especially my girlfriend, who's sitting right there.
Yeah,
but we're not making love at the moment.
Oh well, that's convenient.
Sometimes we smoke
radio,
pot so. And make love too. We've done that before.
Yeah. Well, right? What about LSD? Do you still take LSD from time to time?
I went to Burning Man. For 3 years in a row now, I did blow out the carbs, so to speak. It's a perfect environment for it.
Uh-huh.
But I don't take as much as I used to. Now I don't have to, like, forget what my name is and, you know, can't read my watch or can't answer the phone. I take smaller amounts now as an old person,
right,
being 56. It doesn't take so much anymore. A nice 100 mics will do it for me now.
Well, you know, I think most people of our generation, when they were in their 20s, you know, they had no sense of mortality, so therefore, you know, taking LSD or whatever seemed fine. But then by the time they're in their 50s, most people have a fear of dying, and therefore they, you know, won't take drugs.
Well, I think that's bad LSD if you're thinking too much about dying. Then that's an argument in favor of legalizing that to make sure that the purity is there, because it's much more benevolent. Not to say that everybody should do it. In fact, some people should have nothing whatsoever to do with it. You know, there's two kinds. Jerry Garcia used to say there are two kinds of people in this world: those who like to get high, and those who should have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with drugs. And I think he was right about that. So it's not something that everybody should do, but I just think that in a free society, that it's all about having choices. And if I choose to want to experiment with these things, then I should be able to make intelligent choices, like, yes, I would like to try it at this level, and know what you're taking and how much. And here's another analogy. If I want to be a NASCAR race driver and drive an automobile 200 miles an hour, and you look at a hero like Dale Earnhardt, who ran into that wall at 200 miles an hour, and he got killed, but a lot of NASCAR people still talk about him with reverence, because he made those decisions, and he was fearless, and he died as a result. And I don't think that we should forbid people from racing cars anymore because of tragedies that happen like that. It's just, in a free society, I think you should be able to make choices like that. And if you want to drive a car at 200 miles an hour, you do it on a racetrack, and you have all the safety gear that you can, but you're going to lose some people every once in a while. So that's another thing that I wouldn't recommend everybody do, is go out and race cars at 200 miles an hour in the same sense.
Well, you know, to quote your book, you do say LSD is not for everyone. We're talking to Tom Davis, and his book is called 39 Years of Short-Term Memory Loss. Well, a lot of people loved The Grateful Dead, but not that many people got to hang out with him. How did you go from being a deadhead to being a pal of Jerry Garcia's?
I got him on Saturday Night Live.
Ah.
And the way it started was Belushi was, I don't know, he was the fun finder. He'd always... Well, whoever was in town, he'd end up finding them and hanging out with them. And he brought Bill Kreutzmann back to the Saturday Night Live office at about 2 in the morning one Wednesday on a week of the show, and introduced me. And Bill and Mickey Hart were big fans of Saturday Night Live. And I got Lorne to agree to book them. And it was interesting because when they came to town to do the show, the drummers were the most excited about being on the show, and the one who really didn't want to do it was Jerry Garcia. And he was kind of difficult for the old school director. Dave Wilson was a, you know, find your mark, find the lens, say your line kind of guy. And when the Grateful Dead were doing their camera blocking, Jerry was, you know, playing it differently every time, and sometimes his back was to the camera, and the director went over the intercom, "All right, Jerry, where are you going to be when you do your solo?" And Jerry goes, "I don't know." "Well, don't you want to be on camera?" "Not particularly, no. I don't give a banoon. I don't give a donut in a sack." Yeah. And but then the fact is that when they performed that song, Jerry was out of the blocks faster than anybody, and he played that camera so brilliantly, and he articulated every word of the song Casey Jones, which is what they decided to do. If you're a deadhead, you know what that song is.
For sure.
And it's a marvelous rendition of that song, because the Grateful Dead are used to taking, like, you know, the first hour and a half to warm up, and the challenge for them was to get
to do something
right out of the blocks fast, and Jerry led the way.
Well, I've been enjoying the old shows because they've been now released on DVD.
I've heard about that. They didn't send me a copy.
Do you get any money for that?
No, I'm a writer.
So you're screwed.
You know, writers do not get paid anything for DVDs, and that's why the Writers Guild went on strike last year.
Uh-huh. So you wrote the stuff, they're making money on the stuff, but you get nothing.
I hope they are.
Yeah.
Somebody is. But that's why the writers went on strike, because they rolled over too easily in the 80s when that happened, and now they're interested in the Internet. And so I think they have better leadership now, because the Writers Guild used to be led by people who used to be writers, but they became producers, and there's a conflict there between producers and writers, you know.
We're talking to Tom Davis, author of 39 Years of Short-Term Memory Loss. How did you and Al Franken originally form your duo?
In high school, we met each other in the Dramatics Association, and it was a prep school for boys. It was called the Blake School, and we met every day, started in chapel, where a faculty member and a member of the senior class would give speeches, and then announcements would be made. And I think our first announcement might have been for the chess club or something, but we made a whole production out of it. And it just happened spontaneously like that. And people were, pretty soon every organization in the school wanted us to do their announcements for them, even if we were not a member of the organization. And we enjoyed it as much as the audience did, and that's what got us started. We thought, well, I think Al might have had the ambition to be a comedian, but it was never my goal. But there were always people laughing at me as I was growing up, so
yeah.
I just decided to go with the flow, and when you pick a person like Al Franken to be your partner, you're doing pretty good. That was, you know, it's like touch football. You want to choose somebody on your team who's better than you are. And I chose Al Franken, and it worked for a long time. At least the great thing about being a comedy team is that every once in a while you might be bombing somewhere. You might just be in the wrong place with a crowd that was hoping for something else. And then we would turn to each other and try to crack each other up, and then you'd win them over, because once you start entertaining each other, it's all of a sudden it's fun again, and then the audience picks up on that, and that's one of the great advantages of having a partner standing there next to you, that if you don't die alone on that stage.
Well, now you weren't really a traditional straight man, but I guess you were the straight man of the team, yeah.
Well, when your partner looks like that, people assume that he's the funnier one. If you were to compare us to Martin and Lewis, Al would be Jerry Lewis and I would be Dean Martin. And if you were going to compare us to
Abbott and Costello?
Abbott and Costello, he would be Costello and I would be Bud Abbott. And if you compared us to Sonny and Cher, he would be Cher.
He looks a little like Cher.
A little bit, but I mean, if you look at the body of our work, we did, and if you look at our show was preserved. Lorne Michaels did produce a show where you see our act from beginning to end, and we do take turns, depending on which piece it was and whose idea it was, and it is, we did run against that idea of just one guy being the setup guy and the other guy having the funny lines. We shared
in the tradition of Bob and Ray.
But I have to admit, Al might have been a little funnier than me. It's possible.
So you guys were.
But in the clips that I show,
yeah,
I'm funnier than he is. I made sure I got those.
Naturally.
Yeah, because some nights I was just funnier. You know, it's going to happen every once in a while.
Well, those would be the ones to show at your event.
Exactly. That's no accident.
No, you guys were in L.A. and playing the Comedy Store and places like that, and then
in the early '70s, we went to L.A. in '73 until we got an invitation to go to New York there was going to be some new show broadcast out of live from New York, and so we were in Los Angeles for about 2.5 years, and we had a lot of fun.
So how did you get invited to be on Saturday Night Live?
We submitted a portfolio of about three or four sketches that we would like to have seen produced on television. We didn't write it specifically for this guy who was Lorne Michaels. We just submitted it to this agent at William Morris. Herb Karp was his name, and we hadn't even signed with this guy, but he submitted our portfolio along with a stack of others, and it had us one of our flagship pieces about what would the local news be like on the night of the day of World War III. Tragedy, death, catastrophe. Highlight tonight's news at 11. I'm Bob Kovacic, substituting for the deceased Ray Thompson. You know, now with the weather. Temperatures up to 8,000 degrees tonight. Firestorms tomorrow. That was one sketch. And then we did a commercial parody for a feminine deodorant that came in a roll-on. And we had a musical variety, kind of Tony Orlando and Dawn thing, with the guy who just couldn't get the line right, and they had to keep taking, you know, take 42. And then we had one experimental piece that really wasn't that funny, but it was experimental, where a security camera that's turning never catches the action. You just see the aftermath of where this havoc is being wreaked. So that's what we submitted. And Tom Schiller, who your listeners may be familiar with, he did a lot of the most famous film pieces on Saturday Night Live, like Belushi dancing on the graves and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? Well, that was Tom Schiller. Well, he was the first guy that Lorne Michaels hired, and he found our stuff and said, Lorne, you got to look at this. It's a team. And Lorne had been half of the team of Lorne and Hart in Canada, and they had their own television show. So Lorne was open to the idea of hiring a team, and in those days, the Writers Guild had a provision where you could hire a team for the same amount of money that you could hire a single person. And so that's how it went. And also, I think the most important thing was that he did not meet us personally. He hired us sight unseen. I think if he had met us, he probably wouldn't have hired us. So that was the big break.
So now, you stayed with Saturday Night Live until 1980?
Yes, when Lorne left, and we assumed that it was our show, and we decided to fold our tent and parade away in triumph, that everyone would just go, ooh. Of course, we were very arrogant to assume that, because NBC owned that show.
Right.
And so the show struggled for about 5 years, and we became even more arrogant and swelled-headed because the show was struggling, and we were going, well, of course they're struggling because we're not there. And then Lorne came back in 86, and it's widely recognized that 86 was the worst show of Saturday Night Live. And that's when I learned what schadenfreude means.
Yeah.
Because even NBC took some pleasure in seeing Lorne Spruce Goose go into the mountain. And it humbled us. It humbled us because that show was always hard to do.
Yeah.
And to regenerate it time and time again, it makes me remember how brilliant Lorne Michaels is.
Yeah.
It's really his show.
Are you surprised that it's still in the air and it's done something?
Not at all. In fact, I watch it all the time. I mean, look at what Tina Fey did this year. And I think Fred Armisen is going to be a huge star.
Uh-huh.
And I love the cast right now. I just think it's hot and it's firing on all cylinders, and I'm rooting for him every time. And if you notice, a couple of weeks ago, Dan Aykroyd appeared as John Boehner. Did you see that?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that happened because Dan was at the show because his two younger daughters wanted to see the Jonas Brothers. And between dress and air, they put him in that sketch.
Oh, that's great.
And he did that cold.
Well, he's great.
He's the greatest one who ever worked there,
yeah.
In my opinion. Not just because he's probably my best friend. I don't think that makes me prejudiced.
Yeah.
Because I think everybody who works there knows that Dan Aykroyd was one of the best writers that ever wrote there. He was one of the best performers, and he was a great supporting actor, too.
Right.
He was not a scene stealer. He supported everybody. And he's just a beautiful human being, and that's why he's got two chapters in my book. The first one is called, first chapter, number one, is called Dan Aykroyd. And then I think it's like chapter 11 is called More Danny.
When you guys go to Easter Island, that's a great story.
It is. We like to travel. He's a rambling guy, and we still like to. I'll go on the road with him. He's promoting a vodka right now called Crystal Head Vodka. It comes in a bottle shaped like a human skull, and it's very good vodka. I like drinking vodka, so he brought me along on one of his first road trips to promote Crystal Head, and we gave it the old road trip, the road test, I should say, and it's just excellent. And
so
we
you
were
guys are still hanging out.
Yeah, we were hoping to combine his vodka tour with my book. Like this is a great book to read while you're drinking vodka, Crystal Head Vodka. But it just we couldn't coordinate it. He's going to appear in Minneapolis next week, and I just flew in from Minneapolis today. So, but I do recommend if you like to drink vodka and read. Books like mine, it's a great choice.
Well, I don't think there is any other book like yours. It's a great book.
Well, thank you. The challenge for me was, as a first-time author, was to try to make it better than the category I'm in, which is show business memoir. Tell-all is the phrase that they use. And I have not told all. I've told about half.
Well, which of the beautiful women who were on the original cast of Saturday Night Live did you sleep with? Lorraine?
No, I didn't. But I thought about it. She and I talked about it once or twice.
Uh-huh.
But no. She's always been my pal like that. And Jane is with Patrick, her husband, of I don't know how many years. I don't do math anymore.
Yeah.
But they are still very happily married. And Gilda was also my pal. And I don't know why. It just
didn't happen.
It just didn't happen. But
spectacularly funny.
I still dream about them.
Yeah, me too.
Good.
Well, there were so many great people on the show. Did you feel that you wanted more? I mean, you know, a lot of the people who were on the show, even as supporting cast members over the years, have elevated themselves to the role of movie star and so forth. Did you want more, or did you get everything you wanted?
I did want to be rich and famous, and I've come up a little short. I'm not a celebrity, but I do have a lot of famous friends, and they're represented in the book, but it's not just about my famous friends either. I have my friends who aren't famous, but who were just with me when all the ironic things of my life happened. There were people standing next to me who shared in that, and I've tried to write about them. And my goal as the author was to give people who lived through that same thing, that same generation, and a lot of people that I've met on this tour who are really straight-laced television interviewers and stuff, and they come up to me after the interview and they give me the wink like, I did the acid too. And you find that it is a generational thing, and for young people who weren't born yet, I want them to have a taste of those times, because it was a remarkable time, not just for me, but for a whole generation, and I try to share that with my readers, because it was exciting.
Well, it really was. Now, the book was published by Grove Press, which I think, what other publishing company would publish this book other than Grove Press? They also published Lenny Bruce's memoir.
They did, and also Henry Miller. They
yeah.
still sell a lot of Henry Miller.
Yeah.
And I forget the name of the guy who founded Grove Atlantic. He just died a couple... What's his name? Barney Rossum.
Uh-huh.
So, Morgan Entrekin is my publisher and my editor, and he and I apparently had, when Lorne left Saturday Night Live in 1980, we moved over to the Brill Building, and Morgan had an office right next to mine, and when I approached him about publishing my book, I didn't remember him. But he remembered me, and he reminded me, oh, Morgan, oh, my God.
So I guess there might be some things you don't actually remember.
Well, the memory I've discovered is like a muscle, and mine had atrophied.
Well, but you're
right,
able
now
to remember what people were eating, and, yeah, I mean, you remember lots of detail once you got
what
started.
What happened was, part of the process in writing this book, my memory has returned. And I'm glad to report, if there are those of you out there who think that your memory is screwy, all you have to do is exercise it. and it will come back. All that information is in there. You just have to access it. And my memory right now is really much improved. It's buff. I've been doing mental Pilates to recall all this stuff, and I still wake up in the morning and I go, "Oh, that's that guy's name," and it works for me. Barney Rossett was the guy who founded Grove Atlantic, and he got Henry Miller, who a lot of people think is an obscene author, but in fact he's a brilliant classic author.
Well,
and that's the kind of place that Grove Atlantic is. I'm very proud that my book is published by them, and they've been more than supportive.
It's a great book. Tom Davis is the author, and the book is called 39 Years of Short-Term Memory Loss. Let me just ask you a couple more things before I let you go.
Go ahead, Gary. I'm enjoying it.
Good, me too. So you were responsible for a bunch of things that we love on Saturday Night Live, and also something that I loved that I think you were part of, the Paul Simon special that aired. It was sort of a Saturday Night Live Paul Simon show that aired in primetime. Weren't you one of the writers on that one?
Yes, I was. Boy, have you been doing your research.
Well, I just remember that. It was a wonderful show.
I just remembered it now that you just reminded me. I remember that. There was like one thing that I got on that show. It was something like, it was like Bee Gees music being sung by dolphins.
Oh, right. I remember. That was Chuck Roden wanted to sign this act or something like that.
That's it. See, you're remembering it better than me, but I do remember. I got one thing in that, and we won an Emmy. So I felt kind of funny because, really, I wrote it with Chevy in 2 minutes somewhere, that's all I got in the show, and I got an Emmy.
You won Emmys in consecutive years, 3 years in a row or 4 years in a row? Yeah,
4 years in a row, and then I finally lost, and I haven't been to the Emmys since, of course. Sitting through that show, if you don't win, it's awful. And really, an Emmy is for your parents.
Yes.
That's the ones who really, that's, my dad was never, appreciated my comedy. He found it kind of raunchy, I think was the word he used. And it wasn't for him, but boy, I gave him that Emmy, and that went right in the crystal cabinet in his house next to the golf course in Tucson. You know, it works. It works like that.
You got points.
Yeah. So, and those another interesting thing. Maybe the best show I ever worked on was Steve Martin doing King Tut.
Yeah.
And the Blues Brothers were on, and I wrote the Theodoric of York sketch with Jim Downey and Al Franken, but that was my idea.
Love that.
That was that show worked. Every sketch worked in that show.
Is that the bleeding?
We're
going to bleed.
And we submitted that show for an Emmy, and we lost to a Stephen Eady special.
Well, so that show felt a little Monty Python influenced. Were they an influence on you when you were?
They certainly were. And Michael Palin and Eric Idle were. I haven't seen them in a couple of years, but they would. When I see them again, we'll immediately go out for dinner and have a beer. I love those guys. I love Monty Python.
When you guys teamed up, that was like a dream for me. Oh, it's a Monty Python Saturday Night Live team up this week.
That's my theme about working with your heroes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I got to work with Monty Python. And when my girlfriend Emily and I, in 1978, we went to, we were in London, and we saw... The Life of Brian. When it was shown to the rest of Monty Python, it was screened for the other members of Monty Python. Terry Jones directed it. And all the other Pythons were, I don't know. I don't know if that's working. I don't know if I like this or that. And, of course, I was just thrilled to be in the room with those guys watching that because I think Terry Jones is a brilliant director.
Yeah.
I love Monty Python.
And one of my favorite shows, I think you were still there, was you absolutely were, was when Eric Idle, I think it was Eric Idle was on, and Bob Dylan was your musical guest. That must have been memorable.
Yeah, the joke that week, that was when Dylan had the Christian album or whatever
right,
it was.
Right, mm-hmm.
And so the
Slow Train Coming.
You may serve the devil or you may serve the Lorne, but you got to serve somebody. That was the joke that week.
And you also wrote the Bill Murray character of the lounge singer, yeah?
Here's the way that would work.
Okay.
Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Paul Schaefer, and I would go bar hopping And I carried the legal pad and the Bic pen, and I just took notes. That's all I had to do. And Danny played that Native American character who was always finding dead animals and interrupting the show. And Paul and Billy would just go crazy with their picking a song. We'd always start out with, okay, where is he playing? Now, the first, we did Nick Summers, we did Nick Autumn's, and we did Nick Winters, you know, and then we'd figure out, for Nick Spring, we had him in the Pocomont, the Pocono, the mountains, like a honeymoon place. So that kind of thing, it just wrote itself, you know. Gilda was the one with Poison Ivy, on her honeymoon, and so Billy did a ripping rendition of Poison Ivy, if you'll recall. And, that's how those things wrote themselves. And then Billy would always end the sketch by singing a song that had no lyrics.
Like
so
the
he would
Star
make
Wars
up
thing.
The lyrics. And when, he was entertaining the troops in Greenland, it was, "Vets who've been shafted, they all know the words to the theme from MASH." And, oh, that's right. And when we did the Pokemon, it was, "First encounter, you. Second encounter, me. Third encounter, love." And let's face it, we all learned to sing from Bill Murray.
That's right.
It's in the, except me. Thank you, darling. I'm on the phone.
Yeah, I'm doing an interview.
Thanks for the support.
Well, that's great. Listen, it's really wonderful to talk to you. Let me tell them again that the name of the book is called 39 Years of Short-Term Memory Loss. The author is Tom Davis. Well, Tom Davis, you brought us a lot of laughs in those years. And
no, I'm not done yet.
Yeah, what are you going to do next? Let me ask you. What's up?
Oh, maybe I'll write another book.
I think you should.
Okay. Well, thank you for your encouragement and your intelligence and your sense of humor. It's been a delight talking to you.
Wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much. That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I'll be back again next week with another fine program, and I hope you'll be here then. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf production staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP and From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.